Shabbat shalom to everyone, and welcome to our program. We are here looking at the Apostle Paul and his letters and sharing with you about that Paul didn't come to set up Christianity and have us move away from the church or move away from Israel. He didn't come to set up the church at odds with Israel at all. Now, when I left off the last time with you, we were in Colossians chapter 2. And we were looking at some very specific things he had to say. And let me just kind of conclude what we said there in Colossians chapter 2. He started off by saying that the way you have started with this Maya, so walk in him that way. And the word walk in that particular instance, coming from he's a Hebrew, he's talking about obeying him. In other words, walk in obedience with him. And he's telling you things to avoid. Avoid the tradition of men. Avoid philosophy and vain deceit and those kinds of things. Stay away from those things. Just pursue the Messiah. Pursue him. And the audience that he's talking to is a Gentile audience for the most part. And those communities were full of idolatrous activities, many different temples and so forth. Many things had set themselves up as religious authorities. And he's trying to overcome all of the man-made philosophy that was going on with Greek philosophy and Roman philosophy and those kinds of things. And he's presenting the gospel, but he's also presenting the principles of God's truths, his commandments. He's presenting the teachings, the individual teachings of the Torah. Now, most of us in the Christian world, we weren't told that Paul was teaching the Torah. We were told that Paul was teaching, quote, the church. And that somehow the church is something different from Israel. Therefore, if the church is different from Israel, then they must have a different teaching. And so all this teaching here, this is the teaching for the church for it. It turns out that's not correct. It turns out, no, he's teaching what Israel had been taught, and he's a Hebrew, and he's going to the Gentiles, and he's teaching what he's been taught. And he's trying to teach them what already is in the scriptures. What already scriptures did they have? They had the law of Moses and the prophets. So he's teaching from those scriptures to them. We don't have a New Testament yet, folks. He's not referring to the New Testament that you have. This is the documentation of his teaching that he gave, where he was teaching from the other scriptures. So this information that we hear in these letters, it's not something different than what Moses and the prophets taught. It's the same thing that what Moses and the prophets taught. It's just that we got a Torah scholar teaching the Gentiles what it is. I, too, am a Torah teacher. I don't have any difficulty whatsoever explaining the Messiah to anyone because that's what Moses and the prophets were always talking to, and that was all what it was always leading to. Paul shared earlier that there was a mystery that's been unfolded, that it was kind of hidden from us before until the Messiah came, and all of a sudden now we see, oh my gosh, this was God's plan, that the gospel was to go to all the nations of the world. It was to go to all the people. Well, praise the Lord, here we are. And he's here with the people in this particular city, and he's giving instruction to them. Now, I want to take you to Colossians 2:16. That's where we're going to pick up where we left off last week. And I got a real important verse for you because this verse has been kind of a contentious verse. This verse has usually been twisted to say something that it didn't say. Do you remember me sharing with at the very beginning of our teaching series where Peter made a statement about the teaching of Paul? He said, some of Paul's teachings are hard to be understood, and there are unstable, untaught, unprincipled men that twist to their own destruction. I'm going to show you one of the classic verses that Paul said that gets twisted by men who do not know the commandments of the Torah. And it's right here in Colossians 2:16. It says, therefore, no one is to act as your judge in regard to food or drink or in respect to a festival or a new moon or Sabbath day. So the average teacher says, see, there it is in that verse. That means that you're not supposed to have anything to do with those festivals, new moon, those Sabbath day kinds of things, and those commandments about kosher and all that food and drink. You're not supposed to listen to any of that telling you what you're supposed to abstain from, or that you're supposed to keep the Sabbath. Don't listen to that. Let nobody do that to you. Actually, what he said is the reverse. What he said was, you should obey the commandments to the point that no one has opportunity to ever step up and judge you with regard to you not doing it. And furthermore, he goes one step further. Do not let religious authorities usurp the authority of God in any of his commandments. These commandments belong to God. You keep them to the Lord. You don't keep them for men's sake. Now, the Pharisees came in and they took some of the commandments of God. For example, let's take the commandment of Sabbath. They came in, they said, hey, you know, we agree the commandment of Sabbath, you shall cease from your labors on the seventh day of the week. But then they all got together and they got to thinking about this and they said, you know, to what standard should we be keeping these commandments? And I'm not making this up. I'm being very sincere, and you can verify this. Judaism came up with a list of 1,583 specific things you can't do and keep Sabbath. You know, the commandments are pretty simple. They just said, remember to keep the Sabbath holy. And there's about five other places where there's references made to the Sabbath, how the Lord said he wants it done. But they came up with a list of 1,583 things. And so one of the things he was telling them, he says, we got a bunch of people running around. They're going to come up to you, Gentile Christians, and say, well, you're not keeping Sabbath correctly. See, there was a bunch of Jews out there running around that were following the Pharisaic construction. And they would go up to these Gentiles trying to keep the Sabbath. They say, oh, you can't do it that way. You got to do it this way. And Paul's telling them, let no man be your judge on how you keep the Sabbath. You keep it to the Lord. You follow the commandment of the Lord. And with regard to the standards and conditions that you keep the commandment, that's the business between you and the Lord. James will even go to say this in his letter. He said, it is not sin to do good on Sabbath. Did you know you can still do good on Sabbath? But according to the Pharisee, you can't. You can't do that. You can't do that on Sabbath. Yes, you can. You can do good on Sabbath. You see, there was nothing in the law that specified you couldn't do good on Sabbath. And we all know the famous statement, what about the ox in the ditch? You know, if you got to save an animal or save the life of someone on Sabbath, I don't care if it is Sabbath, you go save their life. You're not violating the Sabbath when you do that. But according to the Pharisees, they had this big list of everything you'd violate. That's what Paul's talking about. Paul is talking to Gentiles, and he doesn't want them to be made subject to the Jews coming along and telling them they're not keeping the commandments right, which is the inference, which means the Gentiles had been told to keep the festivals of the Lord, keep the new moon, and keep the Sabbath day. They had been instructed to keep those things. Christianity would come along and say, don't get caught doing those things. Talk about taking what Paul has said and twisting it around to the opposite of what he said. You don't have to look beyond that verse to see a beautiful example of that. To this day, we still have this controversy going on. We still have, to this day, people read that verse and cannot figure out which way that verse is supposed to go. Let me put it in context. Let me say it. Who is Paul? Oh, he's this Hebrew scholar. He's a Torah scholar. He comes teaching the Torah and the commandments to the Gentiles. The Gentiles, do they know about the commandments? No, he's teaching them about the commandments. He has obviously taught them about the commandments of Sabbath. He's taught them about the commandments of the festivals, the feasts of the Lord. He's inviting them to be a part of it. They're starting to do it. But then there's a bunch of those Jews out there scattered around, and they got all these do's and don'ts associated with it, and they're trying to get the Gentiles to conform to them and their traditions instead of exactly what did Moses teach and say. So Paul's trying to fend them off and defend them from the Pharisaic influence that is with it. We have the same thing in the modern Messianic movement today. People come in, they start keeping the Sabbath, and they have natural questions. How do I keep the Sabbath? What does that mean? How do I do that? Am I permitted to do this or permitted to do that? And so part of the instruction that we give to people when they begin to keep the Sabbath is, first of all, it's a day of rest. It's a day of refreshment. The Lord said, relax, you know, enjoy the day. It's a joyful time. It was made for us, for our benefit. Can you do good on that day? Yes. What if there's an emergency? Well, do what you need to do on the emergency. Clearly, there is no question about it. If you're a doctor, a nurse, a fireman, a policeman, somebody who's part of the civil authorities protecting the life of the civil community, the Sabbath doesn't block you from doing your job. The Sabbath and all the commandments are here so that you might live, so that you might live and be successful. In fact, the final instruction of Moses at the end of the Torah, in Deuteronomy, it says, you shall live by these commandments. These commandments were given by God so you might live. That's what their purpose is for. Now, if you run into a situation in your life where you see this commandment of God and you need to do this to live, guess what is the understanding? Well, do that which you need to do to live. If the ox is in the ditch to save its life, I don't care if it's Sabbath, get in there and do the labor's work and save the ox out of the ditch. And get other people to help you to save the life. It's about living in life. Those are what the commandments are all about and what they're for. And Paul does not want these Gentiles to be put under any subjection by a bunch of unbelieving Jews who don't follow the Messiah, who claim they think they know the Sabbath better than they know the commandments better than anybody else. He's going to go a step further. He's going to give just a little bit more teaching about what are festivals, what are the Sabbath, how do they have to do it, and the fit in our faith, how do they do it. Verse 17, Colossians 2:17 says this, referring to festivals and the Sabbath day, he said, things. Now, my Bible says, which are a mere shadow of what is to come, but the substance belongs to the Messiah. The word mere is not in the original manuscript. Let me reread that to you. Which are a shadow of what is to come, but the substance belongs to the Messiah. Did you know that there's a prophecy associated with Sabbath? You see, Sabbath is telling us about the creation. 6 days God labored, and on the seventh day he rested. But did you know God has said of himself, I am the Lord God, there is no one like me. I can tell you the end while telling you the beginning. How did he tell us about the end when he told us the beginning? Well, it's in understanding the Sabbath. When the Messiah returns to rule on the earth for the millennial kingdom for 1,000 years, you remember, you ever heard this verse, with the Lord, one day is 1,000 years, 1,000 years is one day. We've had about 6,000 years go by so far, 6 days. When the Lord comes back, it'll be the last day. Have you ever heard that expression? It'll be the last 1,000-year day, the Sabbath of millennia. See, it turns out that every week when we keep Sabbath, you know what you're doing? You're practicing to live in the Messiah's kingdom. Wow, that's a really interesting prophetic picture. I would think that any person who believes in the Messiah is looking for the hope of him returning. You'd be wanting to keep the Sabbath every week to get ready for the coming of the Lord. But maybe you haven't been told that it's a shadow of things to come. Paul says that's what it is. It's a shadow of things to come. Well, let's look at the other holidays, the other festivals. The Passover, which comes in the springtime, followed by unleavened bread, followed by the Feast of First Fruits. When the Messiah came the first time, you know, about 2,000 years ago, that's the time he used to present himself as being the Messiah to Israel. In fact, he used to go around telling everybody, my time is not yet, my time is not yet. But he came to the Passover and he said, my time has come. He came to fulfill the Passover. Now, in the fall, there's three more holidays: Trumpets, Atonement, and Tabernacles. Did you know that they are a prophetic picture of the coming of the Lord, the second coming of the Lord? Trumpets, that's when he will come and descend with a shout, and we'll have the resurrection. The dead and the Messiah will be raised, and we'll be lifted up on, and we'll get our new bodies. And it will be at the sound of a trumpet. And at the Feast of Trumpets, you'll find out there's a series of trumpet blasts. If you were to keep the Feast of Trumpets, you'd find out there was a there's a short blast, there's a quibbling blast, a warbling blast, there's a sorrowful blast, but then there's one big blast called the Tekiah HaGadol, the great blast of the trumpet. And the reason we every year blow that trumpet is so that you can recognize the sound, so when the trumpet of God goes off for the resurrection, you'll know what it is. But if you don't keep the Feast of Trumpets and you don't hear the trumpet blast, you're looking forward to the resurrection. You don't even know what the sound is going to sound like. It's a shadow of something to come. By the way, the Day of Atonement, that's the day we fast. That's the day we don't party. We are very sober. We afflict our souls. We're very somber, repentant, and so forth. What is that a shadow of? One of the biggest subjects in the Bible called the Day of the Lord. That's the day that God judges the world. And by the way, when God is judging the world, there will be no celebrating on our part. We will be humble and we will be quiet and we will wait for the Lord to do what he has to do. And then there's a Feast of Tabernacles. It's called the Season of Joy. And we have a double commandment to rejoice before the Lord. Well, guess what Zechariah says that we're going to do, the first thing we're going to do after the Messiah returns? We're all going to observe the Feast of Tabernacles with the Messiah there in Jerusalem. We're all going to have a season of joy. Doesn't that make sense? The Messiah returns to the earth, we get to see him, and the first thing we do is we have one heck of a party. The shadow of things to come. So it turns out these festivals and this Sabbath is pretty important stuff if you believe in the Messiah. And that's what he was saying to them. These things are a shadow of things, but it's all about the Messiah. It's not just about some, quote, Jewish holiday. It's the substance of it is about what the Messiah is going to do. Passover is about what the Messiah did, not just having a Passover lamb. Not just eating unleavened bread with bitter herbs. It's about what happened with the Messiah. The substance of the Passover is about the Messiah. The Feast of First Fruits, the substance is about him coming out of the grave, the resurrection of life, defeating death. What is the substance of trumpets? Hearing the sound of the trumpet and the resurrection of us. What's the substance of atonement? It's the day of the Lord when God will judge the whole world. What is the substance of tabernacles? How about you are with the Messiah in his kingdom, rejoicing before him? It's the substance of the Messiah. It's not just some holiday. The substance is about the Messiah. That's exactly what he's saying there. And yet we have these words and people don't get it. Let me continue with what Paul says at the conclusion of this chapter. He's going to summarize this. Verse 18, let no one keep defrauding you of your prize by delighting in self-abasement or the worship of angels, taking a stand on visions he has seen, inflated without cause by his fleshly mind, and not holding fast to the head, from which the whole entire body, being supplied and held together by the joints and ligaments, grows with a growth which is from God. You stay with the Messiah. Do not let anyone defraud you of what belongs to you. And what is it that belongs to you? Sabbath belongs to you. The festivals of the Lord belong to you. The covenants of God belong to you. Everything that God is doing with Israel belongs to you, Gentile believers. You're not separate from that. You are not separate from Israel. You have all of the same promises. You get the same benefits, the same rewards as the rest of Israel does. So we're not setting up an alternative system to Israel. We're not setting up new promises or new rewards or whatever the case may be. He goes on to say a little bit, and he reiterates this, Colossians 2:20, if you've died with the Messiah to the elementary principles of the world, why, as if you were living the world, do you submit to decrees such as do not handle, do not taste, and do not touch? Why would you ever listen to Pharisees and Sadducees tell you how to have the measure of your faith? Let me update that for you. Why would you ever listen to a Christian church leader say, oh, you can't touch wine, you cannot touch alcoholic beverages, you can't go do that over there, you can't raise your hands, you can't play cards, you can't dance? Why would you listen to somebody tell you you can't do that stuff? And they're substituting that, their definition of self-righteousness. All righteousness is in God. Why don't you just listen to what God has to say? That's where the real righteousness is at, not in those things. Verse 22, which all refer to things destined to perish with use in accordance with the commandments of the teachings of men. Whether you realize it or not, the Christian church is subject to all kinds of commandments and teachings of men. Now, they all think they're good. They all think they're right. The fact that they are commandments and teaching of men, and they are substituting for the commandments of God, they have a problem. They have a huge problem, because all that stuff is going to perish. That's not making it into the kingdom. That's wood, hay, and stubble. That's not gold and silver and precious stones that's going to make it into the kingdom, because it's all going to get tried by fire. And that stuff is not going to make it. There will be no, excuse the expression, but I used to be a Baptist, so I can say this, there will be no First Baptist of Jerusalem in the kingdom. There will be no Presbyterian church. There will not be a Catholic church in the kingdom. There won't be a single cathedral in the kingdom. There will be a temple in Jerusalem. And there will be meeting places where the believers in their various communities. There'll be local assemblies and congregations. And when they want to worship the Lord, they'll go to Jerusalem and they'll worship the Lord. That's what will be in the kingdom. Now, if we know that's what's going to happen in the kingdom, what are we doing now? What are we setting up now that's going to perish and not be part of the kingdom? I thought we were supposed to be doing the things now that will last and make it into the kingdom. Well, that's what Paul came teaching to us. In verse 23, he summarizes all this. He said, these are matters which have, to be sure, the appearance of wisdom in self-made religion, self-abasement, and severe treatment of the body, but are of no value against fleshly indulgence. It turns out that all this religiosity that we've set up, it doesn't help you to deal with sin. It doesn't counter any of your natural appetites of the pride of life or perversion or lust or whatever. The only thing that stops those things are the commandments of the Lord. So being super religious and super Christian does not stop sin. It doesn't stop sin with anybody. In fact, in the days that I live in, and it's tragic when we hear this, but now we hear about great Christian teachers, leaders of big Christian church, that they're all falling like dominoes because of past misbehaviors. And it's terribly embarrassing for everyone. It turns out that all of that wonderful Christian stuff, it doesn't stop fleshly indulgence. That's what Paul is trying to say. He's trying to say, guys, we got to get back to what are the base instructions. This is what the Messiah came teaching. That's what you need to continue to walk in and keep following those instructions. He came teaching the Torah. He didn't come teaching new commandments. Not like Christianity would like to tell you that the Messiah came and set up a whole new thing. No, he didn't. If he was going to set things up, how come he didn't set up the first church up there at Capernaum? Why didn't he set up a church in Jerusalem? When James became the leader of the believers there in Jerusalem, did he set up a church there? No. You know, they go around claiming Paul set up churches. Well, what he set up was local assemblies of believers following the commandments of the Lord, and he was in and out of synagogues the whole time. He was inviting Gentiles to come into the synagogues. That's what he was doing. So we're going to look at 1 Thessalonians, but I'm going to rapidly move into this because I want to get you to chapter 4 of 1 Thessalonians. This is a chapter that many Christians really home in on, and because there's a couple of key verses in there that talk about, quote, the rapture. And so let's not be afraid of that. Let's see what Paul really was talking about in 1 Thessalonians 4, and let's see how it fits into what we've been talking about as our thesis of Paul's teachings. 1 Thessalonians 4, chapter 4, verse 2. What's he say? For you know what commandments we gave you by the authority of the Messiah, the Lord Messiah. For you know what commandments we gave you. What commandments did Paul give the Thessalonians? The commandments of the Lord. Now, mind you, there's no New Testament that's been written yet. So he must be referring to things that you call the Old Testament. What in the Old Testament would be the commandments of the Lord? That would be the law of Moses. So he says to them right off the bat, he said, you know the commandments that we gave you. We gave you the commandments that came from Moses. Right off the bat, that's what he says. And then he says this, verse 3, for this is the will of God, your sanctification, that is, that you abstain from sexual immorality. One of the things that we teach, and when you learn about the commandments of God, is the moment that you start to keep a commandment of God, you become separated from the world. You're separate from that other behavior. You've been sanctified. That's what the word sanctified means. You've been made separate. By you obeying the commandment of the Lord, it has sanctified you and moved you away from the world to the things of God. You're separated from the world. Now you're following God. And he says, for this is the will of God, your sanctification, that you abstain from sexual immorality. That's what the law teaches. And that each of you know how to possess his own vessel in sanctification and honor. That each of you have learned to use self-will to obey the Lord. And not in lustful passion, like the Gentiles who do not know God. And that no man transgress and defraud his brother in the matter, because the Lord is the avenger in all things, just as we've also told you before and solemnly warned you. Where did he get that instruction from? That's from the Torah too. For God has not called us for the purpose of impurity, but in sanctification. Sanctification is all about obeying the commandments of God and being separate from the world. So he who rejects this is not rejecting man, but the God who gives his Holy Spirit to you. So right off the bat, in 1 Thessalonians 4, Moses is reminding these Gentile believers, you know those instructions, those commandments that we taught you out of the law of Moses? You need to keep doing those. That's what separates you from the world. And by the way, that's true today. If you will obey the commandments of the Lord, the ones that Moses gave, it will separate you from the world. Literally, God will pick the world up and move it away from you. A lot of brethren, Messianic brethren, have this, the one thing happens to them. As you begin to learn the commandments of the Torah and you begin to obey them, as you begin to keep the Sabbath and the festivals, you change your eating habits, you don't eat the unclean anymore, and so forth. It's amazing. All of a sudden, a lot of your previous friends, a lot of the folks you went to church with and so forth, all of a sudden they can tell there's a difference. And it's like you didn't leave them, but they left you. When I started keeping the commandments of the Lord, I thought everybody at the church would just absolutely love it. Isn't that what we tell everybody? Hey, keep the commandments of the Lord, love the Lord. I thought if we started keeping the commandments, everybody would be happy. Hey, this is what we're supposed to do. The moment they found out I was keeping the commandments that God had really said, they didn't want anything to do with me. In fact, my testimony is somewhat similar to a lot of other messianics. I get kicked out. I got the left foot of fellowship because I would dare to keep the Sabbath. I would dare to keep the Passover. I wasn't keeping their traditions. I wasn't keeping the commandments they like to keep, which really aren't commandments. They're just the traditions of men. But it became so different. I mean, keeping that commandment separated me from those people. And that's what the keeping the commandments is supposed to do. It's supposed to sanctify you. And Paul is saying, keep those commandments. That's what separates you from the other Gentiles that don't know the Lord. So let's get down to the thing I really wanted to get down to here. Let's look at 1 Thessalonians 4:13. Having laid all that information out, let's now look at this wonderful passage that is prophetic. 1 Thessalonians 4:13, but we do not want you to be uninformed, brethren, about those who are asleep, so that you will not grieve as do the rest who have no hope. For if we believe that Yeshua died and rose again, even so God will bring him, those who have fallen asleep in the Lord. For this we say to you by the word of the Lord, that we who are alive and remain until the coming of the Lord will not precede those who have fallen asleep. For the Lord himself will descend from heaven with a shout, and with the voice of the archangel, and with the trumpet of God, and the dead in the Messiah will rise first. Praise God. That's what we're looking for. And so the Christian world loves to home in on this, and they get the idea. This is fabulous. They get the idea that Israel doesn't have anything like this, that this is strictly a new thing for the church. And they think, Jesus is coming back for the church, and we're the church. They're coming back for us, and he's going to raise us from the dead, and we're going to be raptured and so forth. Actually, all the commandments that talk about this in the Old Testament is talking about what God's going to do for Israel. What? You mean this subject is talked about in the rest of the Bible? Yeah. In the rest of the scriptures, like Moses and the prophets, they talk about this event. They talk about what God is going to be doing. Let me repeat to you what the Messiah himself specifically said. And he was talking to, at that time, a Jewish audience. They didn't have any difficulty understanding what he was talking about at all. They were excited what it is. Let me take you to Matthew 24. I'm sure you're familiar with this. Let me take you to Matthew 24, verse 29. But immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened, the moon will not give its light, the stars will fall from the sky, and the powers of heaven will be shaken. And then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in the sky, and then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of the sky with power and great glory. And he will send forth his angels with a great trumpet, and they will gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of the sky to the other. What Yeshua just said here is the same thing that Paul said in 1 Thessalonians 4. A little more wording. This is the event that comes right at the end before the day of the Lord. God comes back and gathers his people up before he judges the world. And the Messiah says, by the way, this happens immediately after the tribulation of those days. Now, this other verse, 1 Thessalonians 4:16, the church likes to tell you, no, this is strictly for the church. This is for the Christians. This isn't for Israel. Israel has something else happening with it. And what's going to happen is we're the church, And we're going to get zapped out before that great tribulation, because that great tribulation, that's for Israel, and we're not Israel. We're going to get zapped out before, and then God's going to deal with Israel. And those other verses, that's what he's talking about, Israel. And they'll try to tell you that when the Messiah was talking there in Matthew 24, he was talking about Israel, not you Christians. Let me see if I got that straight. Here's the Messiah talking to the apostles, but he's not talking to you Christians today. Do you know how absurd that sounds? I can assure you the Messiah was talking to all of his believers, including you. And what he said was, is there's going to be a great tribulation, and then there will be the gathering of his saints with the sound of a great trumpet. And you will see the sign of the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven with power and great glory, which is what Paul was talking about. The Lord himself will descend from heaven with a shout, the voice of the archangel, the trumpet of God, and then the dead and the Messiah will be raised first. Then we who are alive will be caught up together. Paul's not talking about something different than what the Messiah was talking about. He's talking about the same thing. Now, let me elaborate just a bit further. It turns out that the prophets have a whole lot more to say about this coming of the Messiah than maybe you Christians have ever heard about. In fact, every prophet of Israel talks about this grand event that happens at the end of the ages. Let me read a couple of verses to you from the prophet Zephaniah. Zephaniah is the prophet, you don't hear him taught very much, but he's the one that talks about the day of the Lord. He talks about when God comes back and we have this final event. You know, it's what Yeshua was talking about here in Matthew 24. It's about the event that Paul was talking about that will happen just before the day of the Lord. Here's what Zephaniah had to say. It's kind of fascinating. Zephaniah chapter 3, verse 14, it says, "Shout for joy, O daughter of Zion. Shout in triumph, O Israel. Rejoice and exult with all your heart, O daughter of Jerusalem." Must be good what's coming, because it sounds good. "The Lord has taken away his judgments against you. He has cleared away your enemies, the king of Israel. The Lord is in your midst. You will fear disaster no more." He's talking about the Lord has returned. "In that day, it will be said to Jerusalem, 'Do not be afraid, O Zion, do not let your hands fall limp. The Lord your God is in your midst, a victorious warrior. He will exult over you with joy. He will be quiet in his love. He will rejoice over you with shouts of joy.'" And then he says, "I will gather those who grieve about the appointed feast. They came from you, O Zion. The reproach of the exile is a burden on them. Behold, I'm going to deal with them at that time with all your oppressors. I will save the lame, gather the outcast. I will turn their shame into praise and renown into all the earth. And at that time, I will bring you in, even at the time when I gather you together. Indeed, I will give you renown and praise among all the peoples of the earth when I restore your fortunes before your eyes." He's describing the resurrection and the rapture. That's what Zephaniah says about this event. That's the words, and those are the things that Paul is using as his basis to give you these words in 1 Thessalonians 4:16. And that's the reason why verse 17 says, "Then we who are alive and remain will be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air, and so shall we always be with the Lord. Therefore, comfort one another with these words." This is our hope and our future, what Zephaniah said. This is our hope and future, what the Messiah said. That's what Paul's referring to. But you know what a lot of churchmen have done? They've taken 1 Thessalonians 4:16 and 17 and another verse that's in 1 Corinthians 15, and they've made it like its own little separate teaching for the church. What they've done is what Peter warned you about. They have taken some writings of Paul, and because they don't understand the principles of the faith, they're untaught, and they've twisted what Paul said into something else, and told all you Christian friends that, hey, this is about you, it's not about Israel, and you're not part of Israel and what God's doing with them. That, what God's doing with Israel, that's separate from you because you got a real good deal and so forth. Well, what I read to you from Zephaniah, that is what Israel is going to get. What Israel is going to get is what is described by Paul in 1 Thessalonians 4. So this idea that you think that Paul has reserved something for the church separate from what is with Israel, that is false. That is not correct. Boy, we need to get past that. Now, let's not stop there with Paul's prophetic teaching in the First Thessalonians, because he's going to do a little more prophetic teaching. Let's move right to the next chapter. You know, of course, when Paul wrote this way, he didn't make a separation between chapter 4 and chapter 5. He just kept right on writing. So, 1 Thessalonians 5, verse 1. Here's what he says. Now, as to the times and epochs, brethren, you have no need of anything to be written to you. What? Now, as to the times and epochs, brethren, you have no need of anything to be written to you. He's saying, you remember, you know about the times and epochs. I don't have to explain that to you any further. You already know all about that. Well, for my Christian friends, what in the world is that about? What is the times and epochs that he's referring to that we're supposed to all know about? Well, let me give you a quick definition. The word times is the biblical word for years. Epochs is the biblical word for seasons. He said, now concerning the times and seasons, the times and seasons of what? The times and seasons associated with the coming of the Lord. So what are the times and seasons concerning the coming of the Lord? Well, let's go back to the prophets of Israel. Daniel is one of the main prophets of this, because Daniel is the one who told us about the coming of the Lord, that there would be a time, times, and half a time, which means there would be one, two, and a half. There would be a period of 3.5 years, of which Yeshua referred to that as the 3.5 years of the Great Tribulation. Now, concerning the years of the Great Tribulation, I have nothing to be telling you about, because you all know about the Great Tribulation. How do we know about the Great Tribulation? Well, it's what the prophets talked about. It's about the judgments that are going to come upon the world. Did you know that there's no new item in the book of Revelation that's been spoken of before by the prophets of Israel? The book of Revelation really goes into detail about the Great Tribulation, but all the stuff that's in there, it's already been talked about previously by Daniel and Zechariah and Ezekiel and Isaiah and Jeremiah. I did a study once about the book of Revelation. You know what I call the book of Revelation? The stolen book. Because there's nothing new in the book of Revelation. All it is kind of grand central station for a whole bunch of prophecies that came out of the prophets of Israel. It's all put together in a nice, concise package for us to all pull together, because that's what John did for us. He pulled all the prophecies of the prophets, put them together to show you the end. Now, what are the seasons, the time? So those would be the 3.5 years of the Great Tribulation. Now, concerning the years, the Great Tribulation, you have no more need to be written to. So what are the seasons? Well, if you'll go back to what the Messiah said when he was talking about this in Matthew 24, guess he told us the seasons of those 3.5 years. Guess what he said? He said, at the start of the 3.5 years, pray that your flight be not in the winter. Now, when he says it that way, that means the start of the Great Tribulation is going to be in the season of winter. So when that 3.5 year thing starts, the first season is going to be in the season of winter. Now, if it's 3.5 years and it ends a half year away from winter, then it would have to be summer, wouldn't it? Winter, spring, summer. Okay, it'd have to be summer. So when he came to talking about his return at the end of the 3.5 years, he said this, "Now learn the parable of the fig tree. When you see its leaf come forth, do you not know that summer is near?" He told us the start is in a winter, the conclusion is in a summer. So this 3.5 years, concerning the times and the epochs, you already know when we come to the end of the age. See, we're talking about when the resurrection is going to come. And he says that great tribulation is going to precede it. Now, you know, guys, I don't have to tell you about the 3.5 years. You already know about this. And by the way, you know the season that it starts in, and you know the season it ends in. You know that, don't you? You remember the Messiah said it starts in the winter and ends in the summer. It's 3.5 years long. And so when that resurrection comes, it comes immediately after the days of the tribulation. So when would the resurrection be? Amazingly enough, it's the same time frame as those festivals of trumpet, atonement, and tabernacles. You know, the ones that are a shadow of things to come. And trumpets is the illustration of the resurrection of the saints. Atonement is the illustration of the day of the Lord. And tabernacles is that wonderful celebration they told us about that would take place after the Messiah's return and is in our midst. It turns out that the Great Tribulation is going to begin somewhere in a season of winter 1 year, and it'll wrap 3.5 years, and it will come around to the summer being the conclusion of the Great. And then in the fall, as we come to those holidays, that's when the resurrection is going to take place, and that's when the Messiah is going to come back. So who told you that the resurrection could take place at any moment, at any time? God clearly has a plan. And by the way, that's what God says of himself. I have planned it, surely I will do it. He certainly planned his first coming. You think he hasn't planned his second coming? Do you think he doesn't want you to know the plan? He does want you to know the plan. That's the reason why Paul's writing this instruction. He wants the Thessalonians to know about the 3.5 year tribulation. He wants them to know what the seasons will be involved. He wants them to know that God is going to fulfill, just like he came the first time and fulfilled Passover, unleavened bread, and the Feast of First Fruits, he's going to come back and fulfill trumpets, atonement, and tabernacles. He's going to fulfill all of the things. Let me see what he says in the next verse. Verse 2, "For you yourselves know full well that that day of the Lord will come just like a thief in the night. While they're saying peace and safety, then destruction will come upon them suddenly, like labor pains upon a woman with a child, and they will not escape. But you, brethren, are not in the darkness that the day will overtake you." And he makes reference to a phrase called the thief in the night. Now, many of you may know this, but some of you may not know. That is a particular Hebrew idiom that comes from the temple service in Jerusalem. You see, each night when they shut down the temple, they have to station a priest that stays in the temple for the night. And his job is to keep the fire on the altar going to consume the evening sacrifice. So there's an operating fire on the altar so that when they come in the next morning to do the morning sacrifice, the fire on the altar is still operating. So you got to station a priest there in the temple at night. Now, according to the understanding of the temple operation, just before dawn in the morning, the priest would return to the temple. The high priest would come in each morning. And it is said of him that he would enter the temple like a thief in the night. It would be very early in the morning and still before the dawn. And he would quietly and stealthily go into the temple. And the first order of business for him is to check the altar and make sure there's a fire on the altar. Now, if there's not a fire on the altar, the fire has burned down because the priest fell asleep. Well, he's the guy that was to reignite it and get the altar going again, so it's ready to go for the morning sacrifice. But then he would take his fire pan, and he would take some coals from that fire from the evening, and he would go looking for the sleeping priest. And when he would find the sleeping priest wherever he's at, he would take that fire pan and he would put it to his garments, his priestly garments, and he would light him on fire. And he would suddenly wake up and his clothes are on fire and he'd have to tear his clothes off and, oh my God, and he'd be wounded and he would have to run home naked because he lost his priestly garments because they got burned up. And oh, by the, those priestly garments, they when they became soiled, they wouldn't just throw them away. They would turn them in and they would become wicks for the lamp and the menorah, and they would really burn real well. These were not OSHA-approved fire-retardant priestly garments. These things would burn very easily. And this is the punishment that would be upon the sleeping priest. Now, there's a kind of an interesting word picture here that comes from it. And there's five times this concept of the Messiah comes like a thief in the night. And it's the picture of the high priest coming early in the darkness, early in the morning, to the temple to see if the temple is operating correctly. In Revelation 16:15, which is right between the sixth plague before the seventh plague in the series of the judgment, it says this: "Behold, I am coming like a thief. Blessed is he who stays awake, keeps his garment, so that he will not walk about naked, and men will see his shame." In the book of Revelation, I'm just going to give you a real short, quick course on it. If you will take the sixth seal, the seventh trumpet, and the seventh plague, and you put them together, you will discover they're describing exactly the same thing. They're describing the day of the Lord. They're describing the day of God's judgments on the world. And essentially, he's giving warning here, you need to get ready before that day comes. And for you and I, you know, the temple has been built in here. The Lord built the temple in here. There's an altar in here. And it's our duty to keep the fire on that altar. And the Messiah is going to be coming back. And the first thing he's going to check you inside, is there a fire on that altar in your temple? And if there's not, he's going to light one. And you don't want him to light that one. You want to make sure that fire is still going, that you kept that one going. And so it's an exhortation for you to get ready for the coming of the Lord. This is Paul using the temple system, the commandments of the priest, the commandments of the Torah, to try to explain to these Gentiles how you need to get ready for the coming of the Lord. And he's telling them all those prophecies that were given to Israel, they're going to apply to you Gentiles. You know, the prophecies about the Lord coming back to Jerusalem and Israel, they're going to apply to you Gentiles. There's not a different set of prophecies for the church. All the prophecies belong to Israel. Now, my contention is you belong to Israel, and these prophecies apply to you. He's not setting up a new religious system. And I don't think we should be confused about that anymore. Let me conclude to you in 1 Thessalonians, essentially what he says here in chapter 5. Verse 17, he says, this is interesting for you. "The elders who rule well are considered worthy of double honor, especially those who work hard at preaching and teaching. For the scripture says, you shall not muzzle the ox while he is threshing. The laborer is worthy of his hires. Do not receive an accusation against an elder except on the basis of two or three witnesses." Couple of little quick commandments. Paul's giving some instruction to these Thessalonians, and he says, by the way, that guy that is committed to be your pastor and teacher and so forth, let's use one of the commandments of the Torah. This is how you should compensate him. Do not muzzle out the ox that treads out the grain. Now, if you go back to Deuteronomy 25, verse 4, you'll find that. Don't muzzle out the ox that treads out the grain. Now, if you were just reading the law and you said, okay, well, I don't have an ox, I'm not treading out grain, I don't have a grain mill, I don't have to worry about the commandment. No, that commandment still has some principles associated with it that is applicable to you in the faith. And that is, if you have someone who's laboring for your benefit, you don't keep them or restrain them from being able to freely take of the very thing that he's doing for you. Well, that's a very interesting principle of the faith. has to do with the compensation of preachers. Did you know the law has something to say about the compensation of preachers? That's what Paul's teaching. He goes on a little bit further. He says, don't receive an accusation against an elder except by the basis of two or three witnesses. What's he basing that on? That's on the basis of the law. Deuteronomy 17, verse 6, on the evidence of two witnesses or three witnesses, he who is to die shall be put to death. He shall not be put to death on the evidence of one witness. Did you know that you to confirm and call anything the truth, it has to have a minimum of two to three witnesses? The law of Moses teaches that. That's a principle of the law. That's a spiritual law. And Paul is saying, before you make an accusation against one of your leaders in your congregations, you better have two or three witnesses before you even listen to the accusation. Well, I have news for you. Most Christians don't do that. And we even have the problem in the Messianic movement, too. We don't follow that commandment very good either. But that is the teaching of the law, and that's what Paul is doing. He's teaching the commandments of the law. It's not setting up a new system. You know that verse where it says, you know, if you have a problem with a brother, go and get two witnesses to go with you and so forth. It's not talking about, oh, that's the second stage of resolving a conflict. No, that's, you need to follow the commandments of the law, because if you're going to make an accusation against somebody, it needs to have confirmation to support the accusation, because no one is permitted to accuse anybody of anything on the basis of a single witness. Now, oh, I got to get a couple of guys to go with me and so forth. No, that's not what that's talking about. And it's talking about the principle of you can't call anything the truth except by the evidence of two or three. That's the Torah principle. That's been twisted and turned around too. All right, that gets us through the book of Thessalonians, and next program, we're going to continue on with the other letters of Paul, and looking forward to more fun with you in that. Shalom, everyone.